You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
I'm Nick Westergaard, and this is On Brand, helping you tell your story. My guest this week is Tom Peters. Tom is co-author of In Search of Excellence, the book that changed the way the world does business and often tagged as the best business book ever. 17 books and 35 years later, Tom is still at the forefront of the management guru industry he single-handedly invented. What's new? A lot. As CNN said, while most business gurus milk the same mantra for all it's worth, the one-man brand called Tom Peters is still reinventing himself. His most recent effort is the Excellence Dividend. Tom's bedrock belief, execution is strategy, it's all about the people and the doing, not the talking and the theory. In November 2017, Tom received the Thinkers 50 Lifetime Achievement Award, and he's our guest once again this week. Tom, welcome.
Thank you very much. It is once again a pleasure to be here with you. I'm delighted.
Well, let's talk about the once again, because you were a guest on the show 2 years ago, and all of a sudden, a couple of weeks ago, in the midst of all of this COVID lockdown altered reality that we find ourselves in, I had an email in my inbox from you and your team, and you're reaching out to talk with folks. So why the reaching out again at this time?
Well, there's an arrogant strand to this, but I hope not too much of one. I really believe that the way leaders of a 10-person training department or a 12-person business or a 1,200-person business, the way that leaders behave relative to the people who work with them throughout this crisis, let's call it the last 2 months and the next 2 or 3 months, what they do, the way in which they do it, will be the landmark of their adult career. And you know, you said in your introduction, you know, some of the key things that I've said, like people first and so on. The things that are most important to me, I believe, are 10 times more important today than they were 6 months ago. You know, people first, I think, is a wonderful way to take care of human beings, and people first actually turns out to be a great way to make money. But as we have seen, sometimes for good, sometimes for not so good, some leaders have behaved wonderfully toward their employees. Some leaders have behaved significantly less than wonderfully. And so I thought, because I'm sort of famous for raising my voice, that I would find as many suckers like you as I possibly could and scream and shout, you know, into my iPad Zoom screen, you know, this is the moment, you know, get with it, be with it. I mean, I honest to God believe that's not an exaggeration. What you've done for the last 2 months, what you do for the next 3 months will be the defining moment of your career. You know, 1918, we had the Spanish flu. People are saying this is a 100-year event. Most of us, therefore, won't be around for the one in 2120. And what we do now is just crucial. And, you know, my impatience with people who don't go the extra 50. Listen, I understand if you mortgage the house for a 20-table restaurant and there's nobody in the restaurant and you have to pay your mortgage still, you got a problem. And you would absolutely, positively, unequivocally love to have all of your people stay, but the reality is that's not going to be able to be the case. On the other hand, relative to things like unemployment checks and so on and so forth, I think you can be insanely helpful to people. You sure as hell can have a positive attitude. You know, I got irritated. As you know, I use Twitter a lot. I got irritated earlier this week when somebody showed a very nice thing that Brian Chesky, the Airbnb co-founder, had said to employees. And then it said at the end of this report, but of course he didn't cut his own pay and didn't do anything like that. And so since we are living in a world of Google, I immediately hit his name and discovered that he has a $4.5 billion net worth. And the fact that he can say sweet nothings is a little less sweet to me than it was before I read that number. You know, I'm not saying that if he's, you know, nobody's using Airbnb. I am not suggesting that he is responsible for the lives of all his employees. But, you know, you could at least do a little bit of self-sacrifice.
Well, it's interesting because it's kind of a mix of big things, like, you know, headlines like that. But also, you point to some pretty interesting little things. Now, I should mention, you have a couple of manifestos that you shared prior to this in the run-up that we'll link to at onbrandpodcast.com. I've obviously found them very useful. They're quite dog-eared.
Ooh, love all the post-its.
But you point to an example from Blue Mountain Community College in Boardman, Oregon. And it's a great, and you cite, you kind of quote the memo specifically in there. And that in terms of, well, what's it cost to forego salary, you know, some big things like that. But there's some mindset stuff in there.
Yeah.
That
I must have been thinking the same thing. Because in preparing for this discussion, I actually turned to that page in the paper, and it is sitting right next to me because it's actually worth reading, you know? So I will take a minute and a half of our precious time together. This is an April memo to employees by, as you said, Blue Mountain Community College. You are not, this goes 1 through 6, you are not, quote, working from home, unquote. You are at your home during a crisis, trying to work. 2, your personal physical, mental, and emotional health is extremely important right now. Take care of yourself. 3, and boy, you and I have both heard a lot about this. You should not try to compensate for lost productivity by working longer hours. 4, be kind to yourself. And don't judge how you are coping based on how you see others coping. 5, be kind to others and don't judge others in how they are coping based on how you are coping. 6, success will not be measured the same way it was when things were normal. I'm a pretty emotional person, so maybe it doesn't count for much, but that brought me very close to tears. You know, and you know, so it's a community college in a small town. To me, that works as much if I'm the CEO of PepsiCo or the Ford Motor Company as it does for whatever, the chancellor or president of that community college. And it's so bloody human and humane and thoughtful. I mean, and of course, which is always true with every damn thing I've been doing for the last 4 years, if you behave that way toward your team, you're actually going to end up with a bigger bank account than if you hadn't. I mean, you know, that's when people say, well, you can't do all these things. He said, look, the evidence is clear. John DeJulius had this wonderful line. He's a sales trainer and owns a string of salons or whatever that he created. And he said, remember, your customers will never be any happier than your employees. And so I work like the Dickens to make Nick have a good day. And a funny thing's going to happen. Nick's going to smile at his customers and I'm going to get rich. You know, and so it's this positive catch 22. Somebody said, it was another one liner. If you care about what they care about, they will care about what you care about. And that's a pretty damn good sentence.
I'm impressed that you were able to recall that and get the order right of all of those similar words. I'd need to read that one.
Is that an ageist comment on your part?
No, it's.
I just couldn't resist. I'm kind of. I will say that thank you for the compliment because I am surprised as well.
Well, you know, and the other thing that surprises me about that memo, and first of all, the fact that a memo is something that you want to read and are drawn to and emotionally moved by, but in hearing it again, it's incredibly powerful. But I'm sitting here thinking, this isn't hard. This wasn't expensive. This, you know, there were all sorts of reasons why these kind of memos, this kind of action, this isn't undoable, and yet it's rare. I think that's what your footnote says. This should be the norm. Sadly, it's not. And it brings me back to your other great line about hard is soft and soft is hard. I think this is a case in point of soft being hard.
Well, before responding to that, and we can talk about this a while too, we certainly don't have forever. A guy who I quoted in The Excellence Dividend, Peter Miller is his name. He's the founder of a mid-sized biotech company called Optinose. And he said, we only hire nice people. And he said, and that applies to a newly minted biochemistry PhD from Harvard or MIT as much as it does to the receptionist. And he said, here's a funny little secret. So this is a very sexy biochemical PhD that we have, and I'm totally turned on by your specs. He said, guess what? There are actually a lot of people in this world who have that degree. Don't hire the jerks. My point for saying it, and you know, there may well be a tomorrow and things will be slightly more normal than they are now. If you want people to behave like this, hire them this way. You know, I've been writing a lot of stuff that says hire for EQ, you know, the emotional stuff, hire for empathy, for God's sakes. If you want empathetic behavior, hire for empathy. I believe the most important asset in any organization of some size is its first line managers. Never, ever, 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 ever promote anybody into a first line managerial job who is not borderline off the charts on empathy. That's what leading people is all about. And, you know, I will be more than happy to sacrifice 7 additional calculus courses that you might have taken at Stanford for behaving in a way that would lead you to write a memo like the one you're talking about to get to your answer. I've said my entire life can be summarized in 6 words, which you pointed out. Hard is soft, soft is hard. The numbers, the plans, the organization charts, we call that the hard stuff. They're the soft stuff. I mean, you know, when I talk about this stuff, this is not said braggingly. It's said just the opposite. This is not a philosophy major from a small private school in the Middle West talking. This is a guy talking, me, who has 4 quant degrees from Cornell and Stanford. So I know the difference between the number 1 and the number 2. And so, you know, I've got my quant creds. And what I'm saying with hard, soft is hard, numbers are abstractions. I mean, for God's sakes, the last time we were in a lot of trouble was 2006 and 2007. And people with IQs of 876 were creating derivatives that consisted of pieces of paper associated with mortgages that no living human being would ever pay in a million years. Look beautiful on paper. The spreadsheets were pieces of Picassoian art. And excuse the language, it didn't mean shit, or it was shit in the real world. So the hard stuff is often soft. The soft stuff is the relationships. It is the culture of an organization. It is what we just talked about. Hiring people because they're nice. I remember there was a wonderful one. and I may pronounce his name wrong, the very famous football coach from the University of Michigan, Bo Schembechler, I think Correct. It was. I got it? Yes. He said we usually passed up the hot shots, and his incredibly sophisticated, and all the people who are listening to us have to really be on their toes now. He said, we passed up the hot shots for really good people. And he said, our really good people typically outperformed the hot shots. And the part I really loved, which is kind of like that community college thing, is he said, not only did they outperform the hot shots and we scored more points than the other guys did, but they went on to have more exceptional adult lives after they got out of school, which, alas, is not often the case for the kids who are in varsity Division I football, who do whatever they do and their life kind of falls apart. I hope they join unions. I am totally on the side of, you know, NCAA Division I sports are as professional as anything known to humankind. So let them join unions, give them endorsement money. You know, let's cut the crap.
Yeah,
well, that's a different conversation.
Yeah. Well, you tell, I thought of that when you had the Bo Schembechler quote in your work. And my Bo Schembechler connection is my first visit to the University of Iowa campus was to a Hawkeye game where Bo Schembechler was coaching. And fast forward several years later, and I'm teaching here at the College of Business. And when you reached out, I actually reached out to the faculty in the department that I teach in, which is management and entrepreneurship, and said I was going to be talking to you, and said, what kind of questions are we hearing from students at the undergrad, at the MBA level? And on the undergrad side, the question was really around how grads emerging at this time should prepare for this socially distant, very new, very different world of work.
Well, I've got two different answers. The first answer is we don't know. And so do not believe that you can read two articles in the Harvard Business Review and one in Fast Company and get a formula. We don't know. Nobody knows. You know, I've written about this MBWA managing by wandering around, and I've had a dozen questions in the last few weeks. Well, how do you do MBWA with a, you know, WFH group? And to me, at some level, the answer is easy, because MBWA didn't really mean a physical thing to me. It never did. It meant being in touch with the people who do the work and being interested in the people who do the work, not sit in your office. But experiment. But I think there's some guidelines, and I don't like to give guidelines, because you have to play and you have to learn and you have to. I mean, first of all, for God's sakes, you've got to really enjoy being around the people who work for you if you're a boss, or enjoy being around your teammates. You know, I was just writing about this in another paper I was working on this morning. And somebody was saying, you know, you should experiment with a lot of jobs. You should have a lot of jobs. And I said, yeah, you should have a lot of jobs. But in the gig economy, it is no longer your boss who recommends you. It is your peers. It is when they say, hey, you know, I did this project, and that Tom Peters guy was there, and he was fabulous. I mean, he knew his stuff, but he really helped other people out, and he made us feel good on dark, rainy, snowy days. And those are the relationships that get you the next project. Again, like the guy at the pharmaceutical company, there are a lot of people with IQs of over 130. And so we'll take that as a given. Calm down. It's kind of like the community college thing. Something's going on at work, and something's going on with important clients, and you sit down for a Zoom meeting that's going to be 45 minutes long. You've got 8 agenda items. Hey, you really, 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 really don't have to make it through all 8 agenda items. You know, have a human pace. And the other part of it is, you know, I really think, and some people have said this, you know, we've got six or seven of it. And this again has to do with who you are as a human being. It's starting out with maybe even going around the table. How are things going? How are things with the family? You know, Shelley Dolly, who I work with, who is God as far as I'm concerned, has two teenage girls at home. Well, you know that when you're the boss, and you could tease her a little bit about that and say something like, you must be happy when we have meetings like this to get a break. And, you know, I mean, but the problem that I can't fake is I've got to give a damn about you or Shelley or whoever it is to have that kind of pattern. And that has to do with hiring, and it has to do with promoting. It has to do with, you know, one of life's great secrets, and that is choosing parents well. I mean, my wife is always on my case. She's a Yankee. I'm not, because I talk with cab drivers all the time. And so she said, why do you talk with cab drivers? And I said, well, it's really pretty simple, because they're so damn much more interesting than you and I are. You know, you go to Washington, D.C., and your cab driver is likely to be an Ethiopian. He has been through starvation. He has been through a civil war. He probably had a second cousin beheaded four blocks away. He's really had a rich life. You know, I don't know your background all that well, and you don't know mine, but you and I have had patsy lives, you know, by comparison. But you really... you've got to be interested in people. And I don't know what to tell somebody. I mean, here's this. I was really, really mad because it came out after my last book. Google did a study of its top employees. This is in one of those papers you mentioned.
Yeah.
Its top employees and its most innovative teams. There were 8 traits associated with top Google employees. 7 of the first 8 were soft things, like listens, you know, respects people, blah, 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 blah. Then they get into the most innovative team. And Google is one of those stupid institutions that classifies people as A players and B players. I mean, I've always thought that's fascinating. It is like a guaranteed tool to completely demotivate 50% of people. Call me a B player and I will respond accordingly. But at any rate, their B player teams wildly in terms of innovation and project completion, the BZs way outperformed the AZs. And the AZs were at a place like Google, the low IQs were 220. And they, you know, all had finished Stanford or MIT in 18 months, but they knew it, and they didn't listen to each other. And, you know, one of the traits they found, one of the traits of the winning teams were no bullying. And if you've ever been around a 21-year-old Stanford computer science grad with an IQ of 500 who is well aware of the fact that he's 10 times smarter than you and I combined, but it was just fascinating to see that. But, you know, your original experiment, be a human. I don't know. You tell me. You do this as much or more than I do. If you don't have to be chatty Charlie, but I've got to be interested in you. I don't know what you do if that deficit there. I mean, I know how to say stuff, which I believe, like, don't hire you in the first place if you – you know, there was this fascinating thing. Somebody sent me this. It's a community health organization, and they changed their hiring practices, and they de-emphasized credentials like university degrees and emphasized credentials like empathy. And they would have meetings of prospective candidates. And if you and I were talking and you're the would-be employer and I'm the employee, if I keep my mouth shut and actually listen to what you're saying, that's a plus. Anyway, for the hard number people who are listening to us, and, you know, I can give you the reference. It's actually one of those papers, so please believe me. turnover in these organizations was 50 to 75% per year. Turnover now is 1.7%. And relative to their clients, their clients are going to hospitals 40% less frequently than they were 2 years ago. And it's just because, you know, it's, I mean, I read, you know, the inadvertent stuff of the new technology. I read there was an article, you know, I'm 60 miles south of Boston. Massachusetts General Hospital had a research study, and nurses now stand at the bedside entering data on a tablet. And they discovered with hard measures that nurse-patient eye contact had gone down 70%. And, I mean, you know, let me share with you 500 hard-nosed pieces of research that says eye contact, frankly, is more important for your healing than some sexy drug. But I am now. I do not always listen to what the President of the United States says. And since we're at home, I now share with my wife the house cleaning task, and I do the toilets. And I'm always tempted, because of what our leader told us to do, to just take a little sip of Lysol and to see if it'll prevent COVID-19. I get that little thing in my hand. It stinks to high heaven, but I think this will save me anyway. Forget that comment. You can erase that.
No, well, I think it's a worthwhile one, and it ladders up all the way as we talk about leadership, because I'm reminded of what's a historic moment in our lives, in our country, and you look back at other moments. You talk a lot and write a lot about Churchill and about FDR, and I love in the last book and elsewhere, you referred to Churchill as an average military strategist and FDR as an average economist. But it was those other skills, that battery of
the one that's, and I will, you know, if the cameras are good and catch the details, I will probably tear up. On the eve of D-Day, June 5th, 1944, the British General Montgomery gave a speech to the troops, and they said it was one of the most stirring, incredible, magnificent speeches that had ever been given. Eisenhower, which was typical of Eisenhower, and probably, God bless the Midwesterners, typical of somebody who comes from Kansas, Eisenhower went down to the areas where the troops were, you know, getting organized to go, and he walked along in a uniform that had no medals and put his arm around soldiers and sailors and just wished them well. And the line, they got this out of a diary. I'm screwing it up right here with tears. The line was, parents were willing to send their boys to die for him. I mean, good Lord, what a comment.
Yeah.
And it was just, I mean, I don't know if you can see it, I'll give you a close-up, but, and I've said this in speeches 50 times, and, you know, I'm not tearing up, they're actual tears. I've said it 150 times. This is not the first time it came out of my mouth. Parents are willing to send their boys to die for him. And that is all about, and, you know, per your comment about my comment Churchill and so on, is Eisenhower was a very second-rate strategist. But what he did is, the secret in D-Day was to keep the British and the Americans from killing each other until we had time to go across the channel and get to the bad guys. And he held the coalition together. Churchill, de Gaulle, Roosevelt, Montgomery, totally crazy human beings like Patton, and he kept the alliance together. And that's the essence of leadership.
Yeah.
And it's the essence of leadership, obviously with much less significance than D-Day, in a car dealership or a 15-table restaurant or a 7-person training department. So all of this has one for one exact translation into the real world of the people who are watching or listening to us or your life or my life.
Well, and it makes me think of, you know, really your work being about excellence, but you say quite often, you know, we think of excellence as a great big writ large thing, but you're very clear about excellence is short term. And I think especially at an inflection point like where we are right now, that's magnified even further. So if excellence is the ultimate short term strategy, if it's the next 5 minutes, what should someone listening think about doing next?
Ask people how they're doing and ask them how they feel and ask them about their families. This is a silly statement because it's so obvious. This is about one at a time, parents, children, aunts, uncles, the 83-year-old next door neighbor who doesn't have anybody to really look after her or him. And always keep that in mind, keep people's context in mind, and be gentle. There's a wonderful book, Carol Sanford is her name, and she wrote a book called No Feedback. And the book is about how virtually no leader gives effective negative feedback. They are excellent at destroying otherwise good human beings. But my point is not to review her book, but to say, really be careful on critical comments. You don't really right this minute have to beat the crap out of somebody because they were an hour late or a day late with a deadline. You know, Mrs. Jones across the road, as I said, is 83. And she's really having trouble, and you spent a couple hours with her. And, you know, God bless you. And so go gently. There are a lot of quotes about this, but unfortunately, I am an engineer, so we didn't study any of that stuff. But go gently in the world, be kind, be thoughtful, be caring, and just try to help people have a little. I won't say a better day, but a little less worse day than they might have had before they chatted with you during that. As you said, my one-liner is excellence is the next 5 minutes. It's the next conversation. And that's clearly also the answer, though you do have to experiment with your Zoom meetings or whatever other kind of contact you have. But be helpful, be caring, be thoughtful, be patient. Don't go negative. Negative feedback never works. You know, there's hard science that says positive feedback is 30 times more powerful than negative feedback. And I remember one time when, you know, I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area and John Madden was coaching the Oakland Raiders. And he said, I never worry about players' weaknesses. I worry about helping them get better at what they do best. And if you can't go to your left, I'll find a guy. You know, to stand next to you and worry about that. What I want you to do is take these excellent talents for which I hired you and get better at that. You know, we could have another 2 hours on the topic of the unnecessary psychological and performance cost of poorly given negative feedback.
Well, to stay away from the negative.
That's the next time we get together.
Well, to stay away from the negative and to amplify the positive, as we wrap up, Tom, what is a brand that has made you smile recently?
Well, I gave a speech in Indianapolis. It was always hard for me because I grew up with the Baltimore Colts and then they left town. And we had some people from Hammond, Indiana, who were there. And I took a photograph at home. This is when I lived on a farm in Vermont, before I came to the meeting, and it was my first slide. And this was 2015, and it was a photograph of my beloved 2004 Subaru Outback covered with mud. I love my Subaru. I really, really love my Subaru. It's a pretty inexpensive car in Vermont. The joke used to be it was the state car because it, rides high off the road and handles the ruts and the mud. And I was never a car guy. My actual first car was a 1951 Chevrolet, but that dates me a little bit. Ha ha, we already knew that. But I love my Subarus, and I think I had a saving moment thanks to my Subaru. I was on Martha's Vineyard visiting somebody, and I was driving like hell through somewhere. It was kind of a funny story. And a cop, and it was a, there was a local speed limit sign that was 25 or 30. And so the cop stops me, comes over, and he said, "Do you know how fast you were going?" I looked at him with a smile, and I said, "You want an honest answer or the answer I'm supposed to give a cop?" I said, "The honest answer is I don't have a clue." And he started laughing hysterically. He said, "I've been doing this job for 15 years. Nobody has ever said that to me." Well, that was funny and good for me for saying something funny. I'm convinced it's because the vineyard is loaded with Beamers and Mercedes, and I was driving a 12-year-old Subaru with a Vermont license that was covered with mud. And that's the patent for not getting tickets. But that's on my favorite list. I don't know what's at the top of my favorite list. Probably foods I shouldn't eat, and I haven't had anything to drink since 2005, and wines I used to drink. I mean, we can go through a pretty long list.
Well, that's great, and certainly a brand that makes you smile, as is evident here, and it's making me smile here, hearing the story about your honest answer. So one more honest answer from Tom. Where can folks go to learn more about what you've written, what you've put together recently, and what you're up to?
Simplest question in the world. TomPeters.com. We have literally got, for example, the slides for every presentation I've given in the last 15 years. There's all kinds of stuff, and probably 75% of it's crap I don't know or remember, but everything is there. And I really do believe, and it's not because of Christian charity, it's because of whatever it is. If you give stuff away, people, that's a net. Somebody wrote a book called The Gift Economy or something like that.
But,
yeah. You give it away and it rebounds positively. So for better and for worse, I'm sure you will find every piece of crap and also occasionally intelligent something at the website. Well, and we think it's pretty easy to navigate. So
I think for worse would be a bit of a stretch. But on the off chance folks can't remember, TomPeters.com. You can find the links to everything that we've talked about at onbrandpodcast.com. Tom, thanks for joining us once again on Brand.
Thank you for inviting me for the second time, which is always a good thing. I know you're welcome to come back, but thanks so much. And I would love to do it again at some point because this was good fun. And, got to get a kick out of it.
Well, we've had fun, and we sure hope the audience has had fun. And folks, until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.